in the long run, it's very correlated with global liquidity. And if we have yield curve control and basically infinite QE, which is what yield curve control implies, there's no cap to the Bitcoin price.
This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Whew. We're live. End of a chaotic week. Is this your Super Bowl week, Peruvian Bull?
Yeah. I had a lot of stuff popping off this week. I think a lot of people were shocked by the speed of this move in the carry trade unwind. It was a big week for me and big week for Bitcoin markets.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking some time to sit down with us to discuss it, because for any of you freaks who are listening who are unaware, Peruvian Bull has been following this yen carry trade in the Bank of Japan saga for many years now. You've been writing about it, tied it into the dollar end game, and obviously over last weekend into Monday, it became evident that carry trade was blowing up. But before we get into exactly what happened last Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, why don't we give a refresher of the backdrop, like what led to this moment? What is the carry trade and how did it come to be in the first place?
Sure. So, you know, to really get back, you know, to the beginning, it's good to start with the 1990s credit bust that Japan experienced. Leading up to the 90s, Japan had been stimulating credit growth to an extensive degree. They'd been forcing window quotas, which means basically making banks issue a certain amount of loans every single day. And that resulted in this massive credit buildup and an overvaluation of Japanese assets. At one point, the Imperial Palace in Japan, in Tokyo, was valued at more than all of the real estate in California. And when this credit bubble burst in the early 90s, we had a slow rolling deflationary crisis where Japanese equities got crushed, real estate fell 50%, you know, bonds became the force du jour on their stock market or their financial system. And basically, the Bank of Japan started scrambling to try to find ways to deal with the rising deflation. And this started with their 1999 lowering of interest rates to the zero bound on their policy rate, which is their version of the Fed funds rate. And then it started to evolve into what I call, in my writing, monetary experimentalism. So basically the Bank of Japan trying anything and everything to try to get out of this trap that they had created. So after they lower rates to basically zero in 99, in 2001, in March, they started quantitative easing. As you can see on this chart, you know, they did a few hiking cycles that were very small and very short lived. One right after the 2000 tech bubble, and then one right after and during 2008. But then they had to cut rates after that, obviously, as the global economy contracted. And in 2013, they began their program of QQE, which is qualitative quantitative easing, which basically means quantitative easing, but for only certain risk assets. And then they began in 2016 their plan of yield curve control, which Ben Bernanke helped to implement by flying over to Tokyo in the summer of 2016 to design. And that program essentially entailed QE infinity for the bond market and a suppression of yields basically to zero, including on the 10-year JGB, which was one of their benchmarks that they were looking at to ensure that the yield curve stayed flat. And what this resulted in is, over the last decade or so, a massive buildup of bonds on the Japanese government, the Japanese central bank balance sheet, and an overall, you know, increase in government and private sector debt. So with interest rates at zero, when it costs nothing to borrow, when money is free, the Japanese government and the Japanese private sector levered up like excessively. And Japan, in, you know, in some, has gone farther than any other G7 country with this game, and they did this before any of the other one, any of the other central banks did. And so we saw a total buildup of public sector debt at 263%, total private sector debt at 120%, and a carry trade started to develop where traders could borrow in yen at 0%. Sell yen and then buy USD or buy AUD or buy, you know, JGB or GBPs, British pounds, or euros or whatever, anything that had a yield, and essentially capture the spread in between them. And by doing so, by borrowing in Japanese yen and, you know, let's say lending in USD or lending in AUD, what they were synthetically doing or functionally doing is shorting the yen. And so, you know, we started to see a devaluation of the yen from, you know, the 2010s onwards. That was a slow rolling crisis, but it really started to accelerate in March of 2022. In that month, the Federal Reserve began raising interest rates, and the rest of the central banks globally started to follow. And what that meant is, with Japan pinned at the zero bound and the Fed raising rates and the ECB starting to raise rates, the delta between the two interest rates started to explode. And this eventually got to, right, a record 5% by the end of the Fed hiking cycle, about 5.25%. And what that meant is that this pressure building up on the Japanese financial system was massive. The amount of yen carry traders were, you know, that exist in the system was north of, you know, 20 trillion by some estimates. And that pressure put immediate strain on their FX markets. So the Japanese yen blew out from about 100 to the dollar to 150 or so by this May. And the Japanese central bank, the BOJ, started to think of ways that they could stop this, right? So first they started in December 2022 with moving on the yield curve control caps from 0% to 0.5%. And that caused an immediate shock to the bond market. And it also, you know, helped to bolster the FX market, because they weren't, at least at the time, they weren't printing as much yen now to keep the yield suppressed, because now they let the yield rise a little bit. Then they moved it again in the summer of 2023, so 6 months later, to 1%. And then they decided to do what they called yield curve control, which is just as confusing as it sounds. It essentially means they're going to machine gun fire the rate back down, but not tell you exactly where their intervention lines are or when they're going to intervene. So, you know, if the rate starts rising to 0.8% or to 0.9%, they might jump in and do an emergency bond buying operation and bring the yield back down, but they're not going to give you an exact number at which they're going to intervene, because if they do, the market tends to test that, right? Whenever they gave 0.5% or 0.1 or 1%, the market would test that level. So they decided, we're going to just give it an amorphous, you know, we will intervene at some point if the yield is inappropriate, and attack that cap or attack the market when they hit that cap. So that worked for a few months, and it blasted the yen shorts and brought the yen back down from the 145, 150 handle. And then eventually they realized that the yield curve control policy was completely counterproductive, because when you're doing yield curve control and trying to intervene in your FX market, you're printing yen at the same time that you're selling USDs to buy yen, right? With one hand, you're intervening in your bond market with QE, and with the other hand, you're trying to intervene in your FX market by dumping your US dollar assets with these interventions, which the first most recent one started in September and October of 2022. So eventually they get rid of their cap completely on yield curve control, and they end the entire program in fall of last year. And in March of this year, they raise out of the zero bound. So they hiked their policy rate from zero, or really it was negative actually, it was negative 0.1% to 0%, and they moved the range to 0 to 0.1%. So a massive 10 basis points. And the crisis that you know occurred now came from the result of them hiking to 0.25%. And that may sound small, but remember, you know, with an economy this overlevered and with a carry trade this large that exists in the backdrop of this 0% interest rate regime, whenever you raise rates to that level and you signal to raise more, that terrifies the market. And so it caused an immediate unwind and a fall in the Nikkei that was the largest since 1987, since the Black Monday crash. And this entire, again, this entire game that they played is kind of shown that this this central bank has trapped themselves, what I term as a black hole, in a black hole of their own design. So they've essentially gotten themselves into this trap. And with this level of debt, I think that their options are extremely limited with what they can do moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, again, you've been writing about it and covering this particular topic for years, and you honed in on it many years ago. Like, this is very predictable what the outcome of this type of policy would be. And so, like, do you think they had the intuition to understand that this was inevitable, or do you think they were backed into such a corner they had to move because of the arbitrage trade that was really exacerbating their ability to maintain the purchasing power of the yen, and they just said, screw it, we're gonna try it and see what happens, hold our breath and hope everything doesn't blow up?
Yeah, I think they didn't realize how incredibly fast things would unwind for them. You know, the BOJ has kind of been bumbling along for several years now. Like I said, they've been moving the cap on yield curve control, making it up as they go. They, you know, they first move it to 0.5, then move it to 1, then they get rid of it, then they start raising the policy rate, then they start doing interventions again, and then they tell the market no more interventions, and then once we test 150, then they do it again. And last month, just in July, they did $36 billion of interventions. So they've kind of been, you know, flying by the seat of their pants for a while now. And I think even they were shocked by the speed and the viciousness of this recent move, right? They hiked to only 25 basis points on their policy rate, and the entire financial system in Japan immediately starts blowing up. And USDJPY starts appreciating. So finally, they see their currency going from 155 to 146 to 142. And that is a, you know, obviously a welcome sign at the BOJ. They wanted to have a stronger currency because they have elections coming up in September. And they want, it's very unpopular to have a weak yen and to have high inflation. So strengthening the currency is good. But the question is, do they want to sacrifice their stock market for that cause? And I think that the answer is probably no. You have to remember that in the 1990s, the Nikkei topped at, you know, 38,000, and then it entered a bear market, which took 34 years to recover from. So we only crossed 38,000 on the Nikkei in April of this year. This year. So think about that. You know, they start their last bull market in the 80s that ends in 1990. We see basically like 20 years of deflation in the Nikkei, and then flat trading. And then finally in 2016, with the yield curve control and the QQE and all the stimulus, the stock market starts to finally rebound. It takes 8 years to finally get back to its 1990 level. And within a few months, they raise rates, and now the Nikkei collapses, and they're now worried that they could enter technical bear market if they keep hiking. Luckily, things have started to recover a bit, but that's only because Ueda and Uchida have both mentioned that, you know, we're going to stop the hikes. Guys, we're doing emergency meetings. We're going to figure out how to handle policy moving forward. So that tough language they used last week in their Bank of Japan meeting of future hikes is now basically off the table.
Yeah, they quickly pivoted. Like, it's like the typical meme, nothing to see here, don't worry, we're not going to do this anymore. It scared the crap out of them. And the notion of not sacrificing the stock market makes a lot of sense, particularly when you understand the demographic makeup of the Japanese economy, the very old aging population, which are probably dependent on a high stock market to be able to retire comfortably. And so with that demographic variable in mind, like, given the decision, it makes sense that they're going to go save the stock market instead of really try to strengthen the yen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one terrifying statistic I saw said that in 2018, there were more, adult diapers sold in Japan than baby diapers, because they just have, you know, such a large overhang of the population above 80. It's something like one out of every seven people in Japan is over 80, and their life expectancy is, 89, 90 years. They have not enough kids being born. And so they have this kind of persistent deflationary pressure on their economy. And to overcome that is very hard. But ironically, the Bank of Japan has gotten the debt level so high that now a blowout of the yen seems inevitable. I mean, Brent Johnson has said, he expects yen to 200 and then 300 before all is said and done.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network, and you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their vault product, a 2 or 3 multi-sig vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
And it does take two to tango. You have the Bank of Japan on one side of the equation, and then you have everybody who's engaging in this carry trade. And similar to the question of, did the Bank of Japan realize that things would unravel this quickly once they raise rates? Like, on the other side of the equation, the other dance partner, the people engaging in the carry trade, like, they should have seen this coming as well. And it shouldn't have had to have been a panic sell-off over the weekend for the smart money. You realize once they started raising rates earlier this year, it's like, all right, this trade's probably going to unwind. Like, we should get prepared. And it seems like many people were caught off guard.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can understand why they were, right? And, they should have probably been more prepared. They should have been more hedged. But remember, this is a country where interest rates have been basically at the zero bound for 25 years. And raising out of the negative territory is one step, right? Raising from negative 0.1% to 0.1% and then keeping it there, that's just bringing it back to basically zero or near zero. But starting a real bona fide rate hiking cycle is what the market didn't expect. And in that meeting, Ueda had signaled, right? He said, we will bring the policy rate to what we consider a normal rate for the economy. And the reporters were like, what does that mean? And he said, does that mean further rate hikes are on the table? And he said, potentially, yes. And so that's what terrified the market, is not only did, Ueda hike and bring up the policy rate to 0.25%, he also signaled that we could have, one or two more rate hikes before the end of the year. And that was terrifying to the market, because remember, all these people borrowed trillions of yen at 0%. And if the rate starts going up, all those carry trades start to become, unprofitable, right? Especially if they're highly, highly levered, which a lot of them are. Because leverage is free and basically infinite when money is free. So a lot of these carry traders had not only, borrowed a couple trillion yen, they'd done it on leverage on an equity position on their account, which was tiny. And so that's why you saw all these liquidations. And that combined with the derivatives and, on the Nikkei, and then, cross-border flows that have occurred over the last few years, where Japanese investors own a large section of foreign assets. For example, they own the largest share of foreign treasuries, both on the Bank of Japan and Ministry of Finance on the governmental level and on the private level. Japanese private investors are the largest foreign creditors in the world, their private sector. So, you know, when this carry trade unwinds, it affects all markets globally. And that's why we saw Bitcoin sell off to, you know, at the low 48,000, because Bitcoin is probably another one of the assets that a lot of these carry traders hold as, you know, as collateral.
Yeah. I mean, I think Bitcoin really shined, particularly over last weekend, because it acts as this liquidity alarm bell. As most markets are open 35 hours a week, Bitcoin's open 24/7, 365. So after the bad employment numbers here in the US on Friday, and then the realization that the carry trade was unwinding on Saturday and Sunday, like Bitcoin starts selling off Friday night, Saturday morning, and essentially signaling to the market, like, there's going to be a liquidity crunch when markets open back up Sunday night. And it's almost counterintuitive, because Bitcoin, I think, is a long-term safe haven store value asset, but it also has these other properties, which are that it is extremely liquid, saleable, and trades 24/7, 365. So it made complete sense to me that Bitcoin would be the first to sell off, particularly during the weekend. But it's also the quickest to recover, up almost 20% from the lows that it hit on Monday. And that's part of Bitcoin's value prop, is that it is a true free market. The only free market in the world that actually trades 24/7, 365, is extremely liquid. You can send it wherever. And many pundits on Monday were sort of trying to rub Bitcoin's face in the mud, saying, oh, this proves it's not a store of value or safe haven asset, but completely missing the signal, which is that its liquidity profile actually has a lot of utility, especially during these volatile events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hilarious, isn't that? Like, that they say that. It's hilarious that they use they'll immediately jump, say, hey, look, Bitcoin isn't a store of value. It dropped on a knee-jerk reaction to, you know, an event like this. It dropped when Israel invaded, you know, Gaza. It dropped when, you know, we had the March banking crisis. And then it's like, yeah, it did have a knee-jerk reaction, but did you see what happened in the couple weeks afterwards? Like, it always reappreciates as global liquidity floods back in. And I've been writing about this, right? That Bitcoin is the ultra-sensitive liquidity asset. It's more sensitive than QQQ. It's more sensitive than SPY. It's more sensitive than even, you know, any other crypto. And it's better than any other crypto because it's, you know, has just better intrinsic properties, but also it is the most liquid, you know, money that's available to trade 24/7. And so if you go back and look at the interventions, for example, and I tracked this on Bloomberg, you can see local bottoms in Bitcoin forming when the Bank of Japan does an intervention. So you see Bitcoin last April on the 28th when they had their this last April when they had their Bank of Japan meeting and they first decided to basically signal to the market that they weren't going to intervene. And then yen started to blow out during that meeting by 2 or 3 yen. Then they have to intervene. Bitcoin hit a local bottom of like 58K right after the meeting, and then they intervene. And right as they intervene, Bitcoin bottoms and it rockets back up to 64K. And then a week later, there's an FOMC meeting. The yen is blowing out again, and they intervene again. And you see Bitcoin again bottom at like 62K and go up to 65. It's like almost like clockwork. And that shows the, you know, interconnectedness and the liquidity profile of the global economy and Bitcoin's role in it, right? It is that barometer of liquidity. And so whenever liquidity is falling in the system, Bitcoin is the first thing to notice it, because Bitcoin is the only thing that's traded 24/7 that has a deep enough liquidity for all these hedge funds and family offices and institutions to trade in mass. And so, you know, a knee-jerk reaction of it falling for a few days that's like one of the dumbest arguments I can think of for why Bitcoin is not a store of value. And, you know, currently it is, they are correct that Bitcoin trades a bit like a risk on asset. But if you look at, you know, if you look at its behavior after these crises, it starts to trade like a risk off asset, actually, you know, after the knee jerk reaction is done. So just like what you said, we see Bitcoin fall to 48K and then now it's back up to 60K today. And it was at 62K in trading yesterday. So it's almost fully recovered. And in March of 2023, when we had the Silicon Valley banking crisis, I looked at the numbers, Bitcoin fell to around 22K, and then it rocketed back up to 28K by the end of the month. And then it kept on rallying through, you know, the rest of the next month. And that is always missed by these pundits, right? They never want to mention that Bitcoin always, you know, in the end, over a long enough time period, recovers and even just outperforms the rest of the market.
Yeah, because there's different layers of Bitcoin understanding that exist in the market. And during these events, I mean, I think I could be an example of somebody who's not extremely levered and exposed to other markets. And so when these events happen and those that are exposed to that need to sell their Bitcoin to meet margin calls somewhere else in their portfolio, like the people who understand Bitcoin, its long-term potential, are there to smash buy as the price is falling and they have the opportunity to buy Bitcoin at a 20% discount. And so like, I'm an individual who fits that profile, but there are definitely more and more high net worth individuals, family offices, institutions that are beginning to understand Bitcoin's value prop and acting as a similar bargain buyer when these liquidity events. And I think the number of that type of Bitcoin buyer will only increase from here. People will recognize that you don't need to go levered long and extend far out onto the yield curve to try to get insane returns. Like Bitcoin's historical 65% CAGR should be enough and could lead to some delevering by some large traders that hone in like, oh, maybe the smartest, easiest move is just to accumulate as much spot Bitcoin and not lever it up and just have cash to deploy when these events happen.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to beat that hurdle rate, right? It's hard to beat 65% CAGR. That's real hard to beat for any trader. I mean, you could almost say it's virtually impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. Unseen, at least in modern day markets. With all this in mind, like what happens now? We had the chaos earlier in the week. As you mentioned, the Bank of Japan came out and said, don't worry, we're not going to do it anymore. It's too volatile. We would never raise rates when markets are this uncertain. Things have cooled off a bit. I think equities are selling off right now. Or no, they're up today, actually. Equities have recovered a bit. They're about flat, actually, today. What are we experiencing right now? Are we in the eye of the storm? Is this a temporary lull? What happens moving forward in your mind?
Well, I think, right, the Bank of Japan is now, they were shocked by the speed and the viciousness of this move, like I said, and they immediately started retracing their statement. And on Tuesday, they held an emergency meeting of the BOJ, the Ministry of Finance, and other monetary authorities in Japan, basically realizing like, whoa, you know, what just happened? We just caused a five sigma move in the stock market, and it was equivalent to Black Monday of 1987, and it was just because of a 15 basis point hike to 0.25%. Like, you know, they were like, whoa, what is going on? And I think, you know, them walking back their statements on Wednesday and then saying basically like a majority of the BOJ governors saying, look, we're not considering raising rates any further. We prioritize financial stability over all else. It's kind of helped them realize that they are truly in this trap, in this black hole that I've described of debt, of financial gravity. And so their options from here on out are pretty limited. The reason why I thought in the beginning that they wouldn't be able to raise rates, and I didn't think that they would even try, I didn't think they'd be that dumb, is because of something called the policy trilemma or the impossible trilemma, which is a triangle that has, you know, independent monetary policy, open capital account, and a fixed exchange rate on all three corners. And you can choose one of the three. So you can say, you know, either I want a fixed exchange rate, but then I give up independent monetary policy, which means you'd have to raise rates and lower rates in synchronization with the Fed because the Fed controls the global interest rate of, you know, the dollar, which is the world reserve currency. Or you can close your capital account, which basically means no international trade flows. So, you know, for Japan, which is a net exporter, that's basically off the table. You can't do that. or you give up the fixed peg, right? Which was kind of that's the battle that Japan's been waging for the last 2 or 3 years. The yen has been devaluing to 160 to the dollar or 150 to the dollar. And every time it goes there, they hit a red line, they do interventions, they spend billions and billions of dollars in a single move within a few hours, and they blast the shorts on the yen. They use USDs to do so. And in doing so, they hope to create volatility and fear among the carry traders to prevent them from building up again. But remember, like any carry traders they liquidate are always just temporary, and they're always the most, you know, overlevered and the most, the closest traders to that red line, to the 150, 160. There are carry traders who shorted the yen back at 100, and they just kept levering up and levering up as we've gone up. And so to liquidate them, you have to get the currency to retrace all the way to 100, which is virtually impossible. And so in my opinion, right, they wanted to give up they knew they couldn't give up the open capital account because they needed that open for international trade. They knew that they had to maintain monetary policy because, at least I understood, in April and May when I was writing about this, that if they raised rates, that it would cause an immediate crisis. And I think that they didn't realize the extent to which that was true. And so they tried to switch their triangle to that other corner. So they were like, okay, let's focus on the independent monetary policy and have that fix the exchange rate problem. And they very quickly realized, sure, that does fix very quickly. That does fix your exchange rate problem. That does bring, USD JPY down to 140 handle. Even you could get it down to 130 or 120 maybe by raising rates to, let's say, 0.5% or 1%. But in doing so, you deflate the entire financial system. You deflate the Nikkei. You deflate the topics. You could blow up the Japanese banks. I mean, something that most other people didn't notice was during that week, the Japanese banks got absolutely slaughtered. I mean, Nomura was down 10%. SMFG was down 16%, right? Most of the Japanese banks across the board were down 15% or so in a day. And, if that would have continued, that would have potentially portended a crisis for the Japanese financial sector. And so I think they realized very quickly they can't do that. And so now their options are, pretty limited. So like I said, you can't give up the independent monetary policy. So that means you have to stay at the zero bound even while the Fed stays at 5%. You can't normalize rates with the Fed. You can't close your capital account because you need it open for trade. And that's on an export-based economy. That's your entire, that's essentially the basis for most of your economic growth and production. And so you have to let the fixed exchange rate blow out. And so I think the answer here is they're going to have to lower rates to zero. Or even if they stay here, they're going to have to, there's going to be pressure again put on the USD-JPY pair. And we're going to see the foreign exchange rate move back up to 150, 160. They can try interventions in the short term to blast shorts and to cause volatility. But in the end, it's futile. They'll run out of ammo. And as they run out of ammo, the pressure continues to build. And we'll see USDJPY to 175 and then 200. And then, like Brent Johnson says, eventually 300. Because this much of an overbalance of debt to GDP, it's just you can't solve this problem with anything other than money printing. And so with debasement inevitable, the exchange rate is one of the first barometers that's going to blow out. So I think that's the eventual path. And I think, at this point, the BOJ understands that further rate hikes are basically off the table and they just have to sit on their hands and let this thing ride.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that that currency runs on are risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using ZapRite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use ZapRite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with ZapRite. Go to ZapRite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. ZapRite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
Which begs the question, like, what does every central bank counterparty do? Because that was another thing that was funny. Monday, you had a bunch of economists and pundits getting on CNBC and screaming that the Fed needed to intervene and institute emergency rate cuts and then cut rates immediately in September on top of the emergency rate cuts. But it became pretty obvious very quickly that that would just exacerbate this yen carry trade problem. And so you have economic influencers here in the U.S. who don't understand this at all. And their market is pricing in a probability of rate cuts in September, the highest that they've been at all this year. But with what's going on in Japan, like, how do you think Jerome Powell is thinking about this? Do you think he understands that if we were to lower rates, it could exacerbate that problem, which would have knock-on effects in the U.S. as well?
Yeah, I think he does understand that. I think that's why he didn't do an emergency rate cut. Yeah, it is. It's ironic, right? Like, lowering rates into this problem will actually make it worse. And the reason why is because the carry traders, again, their margin, their profit is that spread between Japan and the U.S. And so if that spread reduces, if that spread drops, their volatility and their risk increases, and they might be asked to post more collateral or liquidate cash, or liquidate to cash and post the cash as collateral, right? So that means a selling of U.S. equities, a selling of U.S. bonds, a selling of Japanese equities and Japanese bonds, right? It portends further selling. And so a rate cut in the U.S. would be actually deleterious to the carry trade and essentially blow it up before it even needs to be blown up, right? And eventually we do need to lower rates in the U.S. So this is all inevitable. The you know, the free party punch bowl isn't going to be open forever. But the carry traders, you know, at least have the U.S. portion, the U.S. dollar portion of that leg somewhat hedged. The problem is on the JPY side, it's virtually unhedged. And the reason why is, you know, the reason why is it dates back to why Japan and the yen was used so, you know, so commonly and so aggressively as a funding mechanism for the carry trade. And that's not only because of the zero interest rates, which we touched on before, which makes it prohibitively, you know, cheap to borrow, right? It's extremely cheap. You can just go out and get loans for nothing and pay no interest. But the other reason was the lack of volatility in the monetary policy itself. You know, as any carry trader will tell you, they are functionally short vol because they're expecting the spread to open up and they don't want it to move. And even if it moves in a positive direction, it can cause worry among the, you know, the bank or the institution that's riding one leg of the trade. And that will cause collateral calls, margin calls, and liquidations. And so they want as low volatility as possible. And so historically, what carry traders would do is they'd hedge, you know, both sides of the carry trade, which would eat into their profits, obviously, because there's a cost to hedge. But the benefit was, you know, they would be hedged and the banks would potentially not call them for margin, right? The problem is with the Japan leg of it is because of this lack of monetary policy volatility in the last, you know, 8 years, 9 years, the carry traders left that leg completely unhedged. So while U.S. markets did sell off, right, we had saw nowhere near the severity of a sell-off as we did in Japan. And the reason why is because the U.S. leg of the trade was at least mostly hedged. And the JPY leg of it was completely unhedged because, again, these traders, the market expectations for the July 31st meeting of the BOJ was maintenance of rates at 0.1%. And so when they hiked to 0.25%, suddenly fear entered the market and everyone was on watch. They realized, holy shit, Ueda might be actually starting a bona fide rate hiking cycle. If that's the case, I am completely unhedged on all my equities and all my Japanese bonds. And, you know, I'm going to get margin called by the dealer. And so that's exactly what happened. They all got margin called. And that combined with some derivatives, some equity linked notes at the 35,000 and 36,000 level in the Nikkei just sped up the decline. And we, you know, ran all the way down to 34,000, 33,000 on the Nikkei within the space of a few days, right? We entered literally a technical bear market at one point on Monday in the Nikkei. And now we've rebounded, but that's only because, like I said earlier, you know, the Bank of Japan has started to retrace their statements. The monetary authorities have said that stability is the number one thing, that they're not going to actually enter a bona fide hiking cycle. And that's calmed the markets enough to allow them to rebound. But overall, you know, this, I think this and other events are indicative of the global central banking regime being stuck in this black hole, in this trap. And Japan is the furthest one, trapped here. And anything they do makes it worse. So they're going to have to basically realize that this carry trade that's opened up is something that they can't, you know, it's a result of their own incompetence and poor decisions. And there's not really much they can do about it without blowing up their own financial and economic sector.
It is such a quagmire. Next month's FOMC meeting is going to be historic. Again, going back to the fact that markets are putting a high probability on rate cuts, but I would not be surprised if he doesn't. I mean, going back to what we just said, like if they do if they lower rates too early, it could just exacerbate this yen carry trade problem. And that is the really interesting part of this global central bank predicament. It's like it's become so interconnected that the U.S. Federal Reserve, looking at unemployment on the rise, depending on what rule you look at, we may technically be in a recession, may technically be on the cusp of a recession. We've got credit card debt at all-time highs, commercial real estate rolling over. Like it seems like the market is signaling like, all right, you've raised rates high enough and for long enough that you're seeing these corrections throughout the economy. It may make sense to lower them again, but due to the interconnected nature of global monetary policy, like the Fed may be forced not to act because acting by cutting rates may be a much larger problem than keeping them high and further leading to economic stress here in the United States. It's just completely fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is, right? They've finally walked themselves into a situation where it's a catch 22, and it's a situation of damned if they do, damned if they don't, right? If they keep rates at this level or hike further, they exacerbate the U.S. debt problem, both the private and the public level. And then if they lower rates, they cause an unwind of the carry trade, but they also will, you know, re-stimulate lending growth and increased debt in the private sector as well, and in, you know, eventually lead to inflation, right? Because usually with a rate cutting cycle comes QE and comes monetary accommodation, and with fiscal deficits at 7% of debt of deficit to GDP, and debt to GDP at 132% and rising every single year, you know, we're seeing this acceleration of the debt problem to the point that we're having $1 trillion of debt every 100 days. And last year, we passed $1 trillion of gross interest expense in, you know, within 9 months of the year for the first time in U.S. history. And if we keep rates at this level, that will just continue to accelerate. So that financial gravity will start pulling in, you know, the public sector debt, the private sector debt, and everything will just start to get repriced higher and higher and higher. And no one can swallow that amount of debt issuance other than ultimately the central bank. And so what I've been writing about has been this dilemma that the Fed faces, right? This monetary dilemma. And there's not really any good options. They're in their own version of the Bank of Japan's black hole. But luckily, we're not as far and as deep into it as they are. But we're getting there. You know, we're getting there. We'll be there eventually.
Well, I think that's the question. Like, do the black holes collide? And doesn't matter if we're not as far along as Japan is. Do the ramifications of the black hole they've created suck us into it? right? And going to like treasury demand, like nobody like look at the 10-year and 30-year auction earlier this week, like piss poor demand. Mm-hmm. And that's the other signal in all of this too, is that it seems like at least the treasury is recognizing this predicament by opening up the buyback window for the first time since 2001. So that opened back up in March of this year. And so the treasury is essentially stepping in saying, we're acknowledging that there's not natural buyers for these treasuries at auction. So we're going to do everything we can to help these markets by stepping into secondary markets and creating this window to buy them back from people who want to get rid of them. It is fucking insane.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is I've actually been writing about this a lot, right? The treasury and the Fed have been finding new ways to stuff the banking system with treasuries. So started in 2014 with the reforms to money markets. And then also in 2011, there was the Basel III reforms and liquidity controls on major banks, on the G-SIBs globally, that they have to own, you know, government debt. And of course, in the US, that meant US government debt. And then it culminated with the 2020 exemption of the SLR. And that allowed banks to basically borrow infinitely against treasury bonds and not hedge any capital against losses in those treasuries. And so that expired in 2021. But the banks in March of this year wrote a letter to the Fed and the OCC to basically beg the authorities to allow them to make treasuries exempt on the SLR leverage ratio again. So allowing the banks again to swallow treasuries without putting capital against them, because they realize that with this level of debt issuance, right, they can't fund that. They can't hold that. They don't have enough balance sheet for that. And if you clear up the SLR as basically like a bottleneck, you allow the banks to swallow a lot more treasury debt without it clogging up their balance sheet and using up the capital on their balance sheet. So they've been using very inventive ways to get around doing actual QE, but finding other ways to do basically monetary easing. And this is not even to mention, right, the TGA and reverse repo, which on Tuesday, right after the collapse in the Japanese stock market, reverse repo fell below $300 billion for the first time since 2021, since like April of 2021. So, you know, they are able to use that as a liquidity source, but that was at $2.1 trillion in 2021. Now it's at $300 billion. It's soon going to be at zero if they continue at this rate. So, they're running out of options before their next cutting cycle. I think they know that QE is inevitable again.
Yeah. No, and the other mechanism they've been using is just over-indexing on bills over longer dated treasury bonds, which has had a stimulating effect in the economy. We're issuing shorter term debt. I'm not sure if you read that paper. Funnily enough, what's his name? Noriel Rubini wrote a couple weeks ago, basically highlighting this, which is typically these auctions will be made up of 10 to 15% of short dated bills. But over the last 18 months, it's been something like 47% of the auctions have been these bills. And that has a QE-like effect on liquidity profile markets at any given point in time when you over-index on the short end of the curve.
It does. And it's also, this is what emerging markets do, right? Like emerging markets are the ones that do 80% funding on the front end and 20% on the back end. It's usually developed markets that have the inverse, that only have 20% funding on the short end on the bill side and 80% on the long end. And so this flip that the U.S. is experiencing is endemic of an emerging markets crisis.
So you're saying the U.S. is back to emerging market status?
I mean, Luke Grohman called it, obviously way before I noticed this. He calls it U.S. with Argentine characteristics. And I think that's a really good way to phrase it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you have a timeline? I know people don't like timing things, but how slowly or quickly do you think this can take to play out, especially taking into consideration the pivot from the Bank of Japan earlier this week?
Well, it depends on what you mean by play out, right? If we're talking about, you know, an eventual move to a full-on emerging market where we're funding completely on the front end, obviously we're still a few years away from that, but the recent trends have not been, you know, heartening. They haven't been encouraging. And so I would say, I mean, I've said this before, I think COVID was the real catalyst that brought this entire debt problem and the inflation problem up by, you know, 7 or 8 years. And that accelerated all these trends. And we're continuing to see an acceleration of these trends into the, you know, the latter part of the 2020s. I think the U.S. debt crisis, it's already started and it's going to continue. And I think by 2025, late 2025 and early 2026, we're going to really start seeing the pressure for almost permanent QE begin for the Fed and essentially like maybe QE for the banks, like I said, SLR exemption for the banks starting in 2025, late 2025 or early 2026, just because of the rate of path of the debt growth is accelerating to the point that you can't really absorb that by the private sector. And foreign privates are buying, but again, their buying has been weakened as we saw with this recent auction. You know, they aren't swallowing as much of the debt, and we're having to fund more and more at the short term, at the front end of the curve. And that's not, it's not encouraging. It's not a good sign for a market as developed as the US. And remember, we're the only country with the global reserve currency. So we're the only one with large external buyers of our debt. Every other country has a small amount of foreign private investors, and that's basically it. The US is the only one with, you know, we have north of $7 trillion of treasuries held by foreign central banks. No other currency can claim that. And so with our own debt problem accelerating and foreign central banks slowing down their buying since 2015, like Luke Grumman has noted, I expect that this debt crisis will finally come home to roost and we'll just have to do yield curve control at some point. Again, I'm not thinking that until 2026, probably at the earliest, but it's coming down the pipeline for sure.
Woo doggy. Should be good for Bitcoin though, right?
Oh, it will be massively good for Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin's more sensitive to liquidity than anything else, like I said.
Yeah. Do you think people are too bearish now? Like how, like if all of this materializes, I don't think people are thinking in exponentials yet, and they should be, because if the US goes yield curve control, I mean, it's been said for well over a decade now, like the US is just doing the Japan playbook, delayed by a couple decades. And if you watch the end state of the Japan playbook playing out right now, like one can make a very strong argument that if markets do take in information, digest it, and make decisions based off of that, like I don't think the US is going to have the luxury of multi-decades of yield curve control like the Japanese have had, because people are just gonna be like, all right, they're doing what Japan just did, and Japan is functionally hyperinflating right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if they do try yield curve control, right, we will see. I mean, first of all liquidity sensitive assets will rise, but Bitcoin trades on a multiple of those, right? So historically it's been seen to be around 3x of QQQ. But even more so, just based on global liquidity and Fed liquidity, it's more sensitive. And again, it always isn't completely immediate and isn't completely accurate, because we do have, you know, temporary contractions like what we saw this week with the Bank of Japan hiking. But in the long run, it's very correlated with global liquidity. And if we have yield curve control and basically infinite QE, which is what yield curve control implies, there's no cap to the Bitcoin price. You know, you got to remember that several million coins are basically permanently frozen, either in just cold wallets and lost seed phrases, or, you know, Satoshi himself, who hasn't moved his coins in over a decade. So, you know, the amount of actual available Bitcoin that's circulating is very small, right? 75%, I think, of all Bitcoin is held by hodlers who've held it for more than 1 year. And so to get those people to sell, you need to give them very, very high prices. And some people will probably never sell, right? A lot of Bitcoiners are extremely adamant about that fact. And so what that means is that the liquidity on the exchanges can dry up, and it could dry up fast. So the actual price we could see per Bitcoin could be, you know, incredible. Who knows how high it could go? I think that there's truly no, you can't price a finite asset, you know, with an infinite one in the end.
It's going up forever, Laura. It's going up forever. I do. I mean, not trying to be like the FOMO hype guy, but like, I do think people have cute, like, 250 to 500K targets, and maybe that is the limit to which Bitcoin goes next cycle. But I think, considering everything that's going on with central bank monetary policy and the global debt crisis, they're moving in exponentials, and it seems like Japan is really going to see like hockey stick exponentials at some point in the next couple years. And this week was just like the nail in the coffin. Like, you can't raise rates here. You're fucked. And then at the US goes yield curve control, similar situation played out in hyperspeed. And if between now and yield curve control, the Fed is forced to hold rates up higher than they'd like, that's just going to really exacerbate the interest expense on the debt. It's going to force the Treasury to issue bills over long-term bonds because they don't want to roll over that debt at higher rates. And if they do that for long enough, the market, just similar to the yen carry trade, it's like, oh, they're just going to keep loading up the short end of the curve. So this is the new normal. And I don't think people understand that we're in a new normal.
Yeah, no, they don't. And I mean, I even mentioned this in one of my pieces, right? Like, the Fed itself, if you look at the breakdown of the tapering that they've been doing, right, their layoff of bonds, if you break down by maturity on FRED, you know, our own central bank has only been laying off the bills. They've only been able to get rid of bills on their balance sheet. Everything on the long end, past 20 years, 20 and 30 year bonds, they haven't been selling. In fact, especially on the 30 year, they've been accumulating bonds. So their taper is kind of two-sided. They're selling extra bills so that they can make it up by swallowing more bonds. But on net, their balance sheet is decreasing so they can claim that they're tapering. But again, it's kind of a quasi taper because, yeah, sure, they are tapering, but they're tapering with only bills, which is a lot less restrictive to the financial system than bonds.
Yeah. How are you preparing personally for this?
Buying as much Bitcoin as I can. you know, I used to trade USDJPY, but with all the volatility that the Bank of Japan has brought into the market, right, with their random interventions and moves and rate hikes, I just decided I'm not going to try to day trade this. It's too easy to get stopped out. I'm going to just let this thing ride, and I'll just bet on the horse that I know will win in the end, which is basically, to me, Bitcoin, a small amount of gold, and U.S. equities.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one thing I'm thinking through. Like, if obviously Bitcoin podcast, I'm sort of pot committed to Bitcoin at this point, mm-hmm. professionally, socially, family-wise, Bitcoin doesn't succeed. I've got a lot of introspection to do personally. I don't think it's not going to succeed, but that too, and trying to think of, I mean, it sucks to say, but all of this turmoil is going to bring economic stress in terms of people not being able to hold on to assets, whether that be real estate, energy assets, whatever it may be, and like looking for cheap opportunities to step in when the timing's right to try to get hard assets similar to Bitcoin, whether it be energy or real estate at good prices, not as an investment, just to hopefully purchase and maybe monetize, particularly the energy assets. But it's going to be an interesting couple years here, that's to say. And Bitcoin is the lifeboat, and it is the alarm system. And anybody who's out there looking at the price swings from earlier this week thinking, oh, it proves Bitcoin's use case is not what it's marketed as, is do some more research. It is exactly how it's marketed. People are going to leverage the most liquid and always open market if they need to. And that is that fundamental use case has utility that does not exist anywhere else.
Yeah, and think about that. They were saying that with Bitcoin at 500, at 1,000, at 5,000, at 15, right? They were saying that all along the way. So it's kind of hilarious that it's the Peter Schiff meme, right? It's Bitcoin is no good. It's crap. Don't buy it. It's all a bubble. And yet every single year that bubble keeps rising, right? And, you know, talking about my own portfolio, I do own a little bit of gold and a little bit of equities, but I understand that Bitcoin is the most sensitive thing, and it should be a large, at least for me, I think it should be a large part of your portfolio if you're getting ready for this, you know, next wave of coming debasement. I think it's going to be the thing that rips the most. And I see a strong argument for why you should have it be a majority of your portfolio, or at the very least, a small fraction. And we've seen that start to play out. If you've noticed, like the state of Michigan, or it was the state of Wisconsin, maybe pension fund started buying Bitcoin to their, adding Bitcoin allocation to their portfolio. The Jersey City also pension fund for firefighters and policemen also started adding Bitcoin to their pension fund. That's just in the last few weeks. We're seeing an increasing acceleration of institutional adoption. And these ETFs have also really opened the door for this, right? It's allowed financial advisors, fiduciaries to have a legal, safe, and regulated way to buy Bitcoin. And again, it's not the best thing for them to do is to buy actual Bitcoin. But for the normies, that's kind of scary. And so buying an ETF can kind of be the entryway, the gateway for them to get into Bitcoin ownership and start to understand what this asset is. And hopefully eventually, you know, we're going to see better and better custody solutions, especially on the institutional side, for buying and holding Bitcoin long-term that will, you know, make the boomers comfortable with holding this asset that's unique, that they've never held before, and they don't know exactly probably how it works.
Yeah, boomers, the products are coming. We will help you get the safe shores. No, millennials too, like... I think for people our age, like, I think it's not financial advice, not a financial advisor, but just like speaking compassionately to people out there. Like, it is riskier to have a 0% allocation to Bitcoin than it is to have a 1%. It's been the case for 15 years, but the risk of having a 0% allocation is only increasing significantly as time goes on. So it gets riskier and riskier as each day passes and you're sitting on the sidelines. And I think, excuse me, that if you're a younger person, you're pissed off that the state of the world is the way that it is because central planners have forced us into this corner that they can't get out of, and we're sort of stuck in the corner with them. Then Bitcoin is a vote of confidence in a new system and a way to use your wealth to say, hey, I don't think these central planning games are working well for me. I'm going to vote for this decentralized system over here.
Yeah, exactly. And that decentralized system is a way to preserve and protect your wealth long-term, you know, independent of the actions of any individual central bank or the whims of any individual trader, right? You can't, even despite the fact that a lot of TradFi guys, even very smart ones like Mike Green, have said that, you know, Bitcoin is compromised now because of the ETFs, right? Oh my God, and the ETFs own a massive 2-3% of the total Bitcoin. It's like, yeah. And that has zero effect on the actual consensus making properties of the network. Just because you own a bunch of Bitcoin doesn't mean you can change the rules. And I think that that's something that they still are having trouble wrapping their heads around, because they're used to the securities world where, yeah, if you own a large majority of Apple, you can actually make changes to Apple's governance, to the, you know, the board, to their strategic plan. That's not the same with Bitcoin. It's a completely new animal. And so for these TradFi guys to wrap their heads around, it's a difficult task to undertake.
Yeah. And I know you're hyper focused on the financial side of all this and the implications on markets and central bank policy, but do you have any thoughts on what this means for the social side of things moving forward? Like, do you think
you mean Bitcoin or what?
Just the, like, what's going on with the yen carry trade, and if we have the black hole moment, the dollar end game, like, socially, do you view it as something as a Mad Max type scenario that plays out, a Mandibles type scenario, or is going over the event horizon a catalyst to actually affect meaningful change in terms of people throwing up their hands, pointing at all the politicians and central planners and saying, you got us in this situation, and having something not like Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, but you know, a moment where people realize things are so messed up beyond the pale that they need to depend on individuals and institutions outside the governments and central banks to fix this problem.
Yeah, well, wasn't it either F.A. Hayek or Milton Friedman who said in the 70s, right, we will never get rid of the government control of money unless we introduce in a roundabout way an asset that they can't stop?
Yeah, Friedrich Hayek.
Yeah, that's Hayek. And so I think Bitcoin presents that that solution, right? I think about all of what's happening with, you know, the political cycle and the economic cycle in the context of the Fourth Turning, which is a great book by Neil Howe and Strauss. And in that book, right, they describe how history is cyclical. It's not linear, that the main way we think about history, which is in history books, of things progressing quickly to another and then the next thing and the next thing, and it's like a logical linear progression of time, is actually incorrect. It's much more cyclical because the generational problems keep reappearing. The generation that deals with them solves a problem, or at least mostly solves it, and then causes a boom period, and then that boom, it starts to erode into basically like a topping process and a spiritual awakening and then a decline and then a crisis and then another boom. And so this cycle of death and rebirth is kind of foreseen in every single society, right? It's observed in every single advanced society since, you know, the Greeks and the Romans. I mean, even in the Bible, right? In the Old Testament, they talk about the debt jubilees, which would happen every 52 years, which is approximately the lifespan of somebody living back then. So every long life, they'd have a debt jubilee and a reset of their financial system. And I think, you know, given the 80-year period from 1940, 2020 is right at that 80-year mark. And so we are right now in a fourth turning, and I think that this problem with our money, the problem with central banks and 0% interest rates and this financial gravity we've trapped ourselves in is finally coming home to roost. And I think that the general public is slowly waking up. You know, just look at the conversations that people are having. Look at the amount of interest that's brewing up in Bitcoin and in other solutions and in the problems with inflation, right? Stuff like that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And now thousands and thousands of people every day are getting interested in Bitcoin. Millions of people on Twitter are talking about the Fed and rate policy and QE, where 10, 15 years ago, I mean, it was not popular or interesting to talk about this stuff just because it wasn't front of mind. There wasn't a crisis, really. And so as we progress through this fourth turning, I think, unfortunately, you know, most people, they don't wake up until this really starts to affect their day-to-day life. And the first awakening, you could say, happened with COVID and the lies perpetrated by the government and the health authorities, and then the subsequent inflation and the gaslighting and lies from the Fed that it was transitory, that it wouldn't, you know, affect the real economy, that you know, it would, we'd retrace and get back to normal price levels after the pandemic, which of course has never happened. And people's own anecdotal experience seeing inflation rise much more quickly and much more aggressively than even their statistics mention also caused this lack of faith. So I think people are waking up, and unfortunately, most people don't wake up until it's very late in the game. You know, I'm not thinking that we would have a Mad Max style, you know, just zombie movie shotgun your neighbor kind of apocalypse, right? Even if you study other hyperinflations, there is severe strain on the economy. There's severe strain on people and on, you know, their mental and psychological well-being, for sure. But people find a way to survive. People find solutions. People look for new you know, new opportunities, new ways to cope with it. And that means, right, they can mean in Zimbabwe in 2008, they started using, during their hyperinflation, they used fuel coupons as money instead of the Zimbabwe dollar. So they got these fuel coupons from the government. They would use them for, each one was valuable for or valid for 1 liter of fuel. And they would just trade that as a form of money in between themselves to facilitate trade and to, you know, settle transactions. So who's to say that that couldn't happen with Bitcoin? And so I think ultimately that would accelerate Bitcoin adoption. But unfortunately, again, most people, 80%, are not going to get the memo until it's really late and we see Bitcoin at 500K and inflation's at 30% and the Fed is doing yield curve control and they're like, holy shit, I need to get some of this. Yeah, well, you probably should have gotten some like 5 years ago, but that's why we're here early and that's why we're right ultimately.
Yeah. And it's not only the fact that people are having these conversations. I think it's like a layer deeper than that, which is like they're actually able to have them in the first place because of the communications, technology, social media, and all of that. And I think I agree with everything. I think there will definitely, most people will be laggards, but the rising tide of Bitcoin lifts all boats at the end of the day. And Bitcoin is just one part of the equation. I think on the back end of this event horizon, we really do need some structural societal change and conversations like this. The ability to have this conversation, distribute it, give me immense hope that the signal will get out there once people recognize that there's a problem, go and search for a solution. And there's more of these types of conversations available than ever before. And they will obviously continue to happen, and not only that, but continue to increase in terms of the amount of people that are putting this type of content out there and trying to educate people. And so it is very heavy to sort of grasp the fact that the global financial system is in a very precarious situation, but conversations like this, and more importantly, the ability to have it and distribute it, give me a lot of optimism for the future that we'll actually be able to affect change. And despite what many people will say about the efficacy of the mainstream media, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. There's media, there's media entities are dying. I think we saw Universal had to write down like a $1 billion loss because CNN just isn't selling ad dollars because people aren't watching it anymore. And so I do think socially people are shifting towards these types of interviews, these conversations with people outside the mainstream, which should have a overall net positive on actually being able to affect change moving forward.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, look at the decentralization of, you know, basically every form of media, whether it be podcasts or YouTube, right? The growth of Bitcoin podcasts like your own, the growth of alternative media podcasts, the growth of, you know, independent writers like on Substack, like I write, and there's other, you know, plenty of journalists and independent, you know, analysts and thinkers. The future is decentralized. And that means more than just the money. It means our media, it means our entertainment, you know, potentially even our TV and cinema, right? We could have decentralized studios that just raise money for certain projects that people want to see a movie of, rather than these large centralized corporations that shove the woke agenda down your throat, you know? And I think that's massively bullish for the next turning, for the next, you know, first turning. And I think it's massively bullish for freedom in general. And I think, like I said, Bitcoin is one of the catalysts to get us there.
Completely agree. Completely agree. We're going to win. We're going to win. It's going to be a little chaotic, but hold on to your butts, freaks. Make sure you've got some Bitcoin and make sure you're staying on top of all this. And I really appreciate you taking some time out of your Super Bowl week to come have this discussion, because I think it's important that people really grok what's happening and the larger game that's being played, particularly at the central bank level. It's really important work, and kudos to you for being on top of this for many years leading up to the events of earlier this week. It was a good call. You stuck with it, and it seems to be manifesting in real time.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I did start following it well over a year ago, and I actually, it's almost 2 years ago now, where's my first post about it. And most people were like, why are you talking about Japan? You know, why are you so interested in Japanese, you know, monetary policy and their FX and all this stuff that's going on? And I was like, look, guys, I think, you know, it's become almost a meme now, but I think Japan is the canary in the coal mine, right? They're the first central bank to go this far down the monetary experimentalism rabbit hole. And the consequences for Japan are a foreshadowing of consequences for every central bank that has followed their, you know, QE and 0% interest rate policy. And so what's happening to Japan right now is eventually going to happen to every central bank globally, where raising rates at all will not be an option, and they'll just have to pin them at the zero bound, do QE, and, you know, let the currency blow out. And so seeing that on the writing on the wall is good, because people can get prepared, buy some Bitcoin, protect themselves, and, you know, get ready to ride through the rest of this fourth turning.
Yeah. And I was just typing there to make sure I have the URL of your Substack correct. So go to dollarendgame.substack.com. Peruvian Bulls, writing about this carry trade and many other economic topics on a weekly basis. And it's high signal content that should help you weather this storm better than most. So if you're not subscribed already, go check it out.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And I also have a Twitter, obviously, at Peruvian_Bull. And I have a YouTube as well, where I'm going to start transforming my weekly Substacks into also videos. So if you're interested in that kind of content, you can go check it out and subscribe there.
Awesome. We'll link to all that in the show notes. Sir, go enjoy the rest of your Friday, and I'm sure we'll be catching up at some point soon.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks so much, Marty. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Peace and love, freaks.